you think of Art Deco, what comes to mind? For me, it's South Beach in Miami. But right under our noses, here in New York City, is an amazing array of Art Deco architecture, from the Chrysler Building to apartment buildings along the Bronx's Grand Concourse. Good morning. I'm George Podarchy, and this is Cityscape on 90.7 FM and WFUV.org. This morning, we're looking at Art Deco up high and down low, from skyscrapers to the mailboxes in their lobbies. Our first guests are all about Art Deco. Roberta Newsom is president, and Megan Weatherby is the director of operations of the Art Deco Society of New York. Tony W. Robbins is an early member of the group. He's also an author, lecturer, and tour leader. Roberta, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Megan, hello.
Hello.
And Tony, thank you for being here.
Oh, it's a great pleasure. Thank you.
So who wants to define Art Deco? What is Art Deco? Who wants to take that question?
Well, that's been the subject of a great debate for a very long time. I like to say that it's been described the way that the Supreme Court Justice of the United States tried to describe pornography, and that is, you know it when you see it. But maybe we'll have Tony tell us a little bit more about his definition.
Well, it's, the phrase didn't even exist until 1966. If you're talking about architecture, architects in the 30s talked about the vertical style. They talked about being modernistic. And Art Deco is a latecomer as a phrase. And it's been used to describe all kinds of things, everything from salt cellars to skyscrapers, fabrics, jewelry, painting, sculpture, anything designed with an abstract geometric pattern or a stylized floral pattern, something that looks natural but you won't actually find in nature. Anything like that in the late 1920s and into the early 30s, into the mid-30s, into the late 30s, the early 40s, the mid-40s, in Europe and North America and South America and Indonesia and India and New Zealand and Australia. It's so widely used, it almost doesn't mean anything. But when it comes to architecture, it's a very specific phenomenon, especially American architecture. It's a very specific phenomenon. It's a style that had its sources in various places, but came together in a series of skyscrapers in New York. The first really important book on the subject in New York called it the skyscraper style, and I think there's something to that.
So that being said, what are the most iconic examples of Art Deco in New York City?
Well, if we're talking architecture, then the Chrysler Building, absolutely, but a whole host of those skyscrapers. I mean, there were about 24 of them. You get the City Service Building at 70 Pine Street, One Wall Street built for the Irving Trust, the Daily News Building, although some would argue that that's really more early modern, but that's an argument we can have some other time, the Chanin Building, the General Electric Building on Lexington and 50th Street, the Waldorf Astoria Hotel. It goes on and on and on.
Roberta, where did Art Deco originate?
Well, there's basically in 1925 in France, there was a major exposition, and people from around the world came to see a new modern style of architecture and design. And although the word was not coined until the 1960s, it started in France, it started in Paris, and then it was transformed around the world, and New York gave it its own special style.
Megan, what inspires you most about Art Deco?
I originally got into Art Deco mostly through the decorative arts and design, but then kind of as I dove into it more, the culture of the 20s and 30s is just like nothing else. And I think a lot of young people were inspired by Gatsby and inspired by all these revamps of Art Deco literature and the style itself.
Yeah, I was going to say, you're young, let me say that, right?
Yes.
Roberta, what does your organization do to engage young people in the world of Art Deco?
It's very important for us to really reach out to the next generation. And in the last 2 years, we started a Young Deco Friends group, trying to capture the interest of young people, starting with the Gatsby phenomenon. We know that there's lots of young people who love to dress up, dance, drink the famous drinks of those periods, love the speakeasy style. And capturing that interest and then having young people start to get more and more involved in New York in the 1920s and the various aspects of culture of the city of the time, and then leading them to the great architecture and design of the period has been really one of the most exciting things that we've seen happen in the organization in the last couple of years. We have over 250 Young Deco friends today.
What is the primary mission of the Art Deco Society?
Well, our mission has always been to educate, to engage people in that period, to get involved in the preservation of those buildings, to make sure that they remain the iconic structures that they are, and also to have people understand that this was a style that permeated all of the neighborhoods of New York. one of the great areas for great Art Deco buildings are the apartment houses, for example, on the Grand Concourse. So there's Art Deco all around, and we think it's important to open people's eyes to that. In fact, we've just started a new school program called Documenting Deco, with the goal of going to our students in our city schools and have them discover their own Art Deco buildings in their neighborhoods, document them through photographs, and enter a citywide photography contest.
Now, the Society has been around since the early 80s, right?
Since the early 80s, and I guess Tony has been involved since...
1984, and it was, I think it was about a year old at the time. It was just a group of people who really loved this stuff, you know, and it was something that got rediscovered, at least among people I knew in New York in the late 70s. I still remember friends saying, that looks like it's from the 30s. Oh, yeah, you're right. Look at that. And it was just the beginning. The people who came to form the Society tended to be people interested in the decorative arts, not so much architecture, and fashion especially, but also jewelry. My interest is architecture, so I ended up putting together the walking tour. And no one had ever done walking tours of Art Deco before. I mean, by now, everybody's done them.
What are your favorite places to walk people around to view Art Deco in the city?
Well, you have to start with Midtown because that's where the great monuments are, the Chrysler Building, the Daily News, and so on. But, you know, it's wonderful to drive through the Bronx and look at the buildings on the Grand Concourse, or look at the Rainy Gates here at the Bronx Zoo, or go through Herman Reuter's high school, junior high school. There aren't too many Art Deco public schools in New York. There are two I can think of. One of them is here in the Bronx. Or go out in Brighton Beach. You know, this beach community from the 20s and the 30s, and there are some of the most interesting Art Deco ornament on buildings out there. It's everywhere. There are thousands of these buildings. You know, and they come from a point when the city was really expanding into this large, new, middle-class complex. Everything was about mass culture. Skyscrapers have masses of building in them. Apartments have masses of building in them. And bus terminals and airline terminals serve masses of people. And that's where the Deco really got going. So it's exciting to see it almost wherever it is.
Who are among the top architects of Art Deco?
Well, there are four really in New York who are really important. There's Raymond Hood. Again, some would say his stuff was more early modern than Art Deco, but it was totally influential in what became the Art Deco style. William Van Allen, who's really just a one-building architect. I mean, he did a few other things, but he's known for the Chrysler Building. Ralph Walker, whose stuff is downtown from One Wall Street, the buildings he did for the telephone company, the Barclay VZ building, the Western Union building. And then there's Elie Jacquin, who did, close to 70 buildings all over the city, from reasonably high-class office buildings like 2 Park Avenue to mostly, well, really more buildings in the garment district, the printing district. And he sort of created these workaday versions of what had been a high style in something like the Chrysler Building. But those four were it. And they used to meet for lunch every Friday, what they called the four-hour lunch club. They would have visitors. And they would, frankly, Wright had, you know, was there once, apparently, and they would chat about architecture. So they all knew what they were doing. All other architects began to get into this, you know, once it got established. But those are the four I think were the most important in New York City.
Megan, what are your favorite examples of Art Deco in New York City?
I come from a different side. I come from the decorative arts and design side. So I don't come with as much knowledge as Tony has. So I have to say, obviously, the Chrysler Building, it's just so iconic. There's really nothing else similar to it. I also love the American Radiator Building, which is over by the New York Public Library. It's just that really rich black and gold building. And you walk along the street and all of a sudden you look up and you're like, oh, my gosh, like, what is this? And then obviously the Empire State Building and Rockefeller Center as a whole, just everything there is so aesthetically amazing.
So, Megan, tell us more about your area of expertise.
So I really come from the decorative arts and design. So anything that is not fine art, so anything that's not painting or sculpture is considered deck arts. So that's furniture, and that's really what I studied in the relationship between Paris Art Deco and New York Art Deco, and kind of how Paris was creating this style for the elite, and it was this luxurious materials and things that were extremely expensive. And after the 1925 World's Fair, America started to really create modern design in that aesthetic, and then it became their own style, and they kind of interpreted it in different ways to make it more for the mass public and readily available where people could decorate their own homes with it.
If we want to get a glimpse into Art Deco interiors and see furniture here in New York City, where do you suggest we go?
Well, there are all sorts of galleries and dealers. Obviously, a lot of the museums have deco collections, but it's not something that is readily on view in the same way that architecture is. So we have a list on our website of our dealers and people who we think have really great Art Deco. And so I would recommend going to that and looking on there.
Roberta, on your website, you also categorize all of the buildings, right?
Well, not all of the buildings. We have about 200 buildings so far. This is a brand new effort that we started, I guess, less than a year ago. Our long-term goal is to have a registry of all buildings with an Art Deco interior or facade in the five boroughs. That's a very ambitious goal, and that's why we welcome any contributions to that. As people are walking by a building, please let us know if you think that it's a Deco building, and we'll check, and if so, we'll add it to our registry.
What Art Deco buildings in New York City today are or might be in danger?
Well, one of the areas where we are really focusing is not the iconic buildings or the landmark buildings, because there are many of those, but there are buildings throughout the boroughs that deserve care. Right now, for example, in the Bronx, there are some wonderful buildings that have Art Deco lobbies, but they're tired. You know, they're 80 years old and they're getting tired. So one of the efforts that we'd like to make is to be able to help building owners or shareholders in co-ops look at their buildings and find affordable ways to bring their lobbies back to their grandeur.
Tony, you referenced the 1970s when there was a resurgence in interest in Art Deco. Mm-hmm. What can you attribute that to in the 1970s and 80s? What was it about that time period that led to a greater interest in Art Deco?
Well, remember that this was also a period that saw the really growth of interest in historic buildings in general and landmarks preservation in general, which in turn was in part a response to what many thought of as a kind of a soulless modernism that had taken over the cities. I mean, there were great masters in the Bauhaus, Mies van der Rohe, who did the Seagram building as a towering figure. But most of what seemed to follow were pretty lifeless imitations. They were basically, oh, this is a great excuse to be cheap. So glass and metal buildings of no particular distinction that were going up everywhere. And here was Art Deco, and it was sort of an alternative modernism. But one that wasn't as austere and high-minded as the Seagram Tower, but could also be fun even in cheap knockoff buildings, whereas international style, I think that's a lot harder. And they were wonderful. And why didn't anyone tell us about these things? And this is what I like in the way of modernism. I mean, there was also the sort of grandchild-grandparent phenomenon going on. We disdain what our parents did. We rediscover what our grandparents mm-hmm. did. So there's a generational piece to it also. But just, it's so easy to like it. It's so much fun. And I think what Megan has to say about it's representing a very particular lifestyle, I think that also accounts for some of it. Certainly the early Art Deco events were all about having parties. They really were. And there was something about the style that really suggests that.
Roberta, why did Art Deco fall out of style in the first place?
Well, that's a very interesting question, because if you ask Megan from her design standpoint, she doesn't think it actually did.
Huh.
So maybe we'll turn that over to Megan to talk about why she thinks it's still very much with us.
Well, I think there, in mid-century modern furniture, it definitely took the form of Art Deco and basically just simplified the surface even more. So Art Deco was all about the lack of added decoration. So they would inlay different materials into furniture. So mid-century modern just went one step further and basically just took that out and had completely clean surfaces. And I think that influence is still prevalent today. And I think if you look at the way societies are now, is still very reminiscent of the Art Deco era. I think that even the fact that we're on a radio show, that was the golden age of radio,
yeah.
I think... fashion designers are re-referencing that and basically re-exposing new audiences to Art Deco through jewelry and fashion, starlets on red carpets, or, that age of glamour and that old Hollywood look. It's still very much in our aesthetic vocabulary today.
What is the biggest Art Deco loss in New York City, would you say?
Wow. I'm not sure. I could think of a couple. The Airlines Terminal building that was on the south west corner of 42nd Street and Park Avenue, right across from Grand Central, comes to mind. We haven't lost any Art Deco skyscrapers. I mean, skyscrapers do come down from time to time, but nothing major that way. I think a lot of the damage done to buildings on the Grand Concourse would be a loss. A lot of the original doorways are gone. The windows were all ripped out and replaced with really inappropriate replacements. And that was definitely a loss. The landmark designation of the Grand Concourse Historic District didn't happen in time to stop that. That can be undone in terms of the windows. The doors are a bit harder because they were all individual designs.
Tony, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Megan, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Roberta, thank you.
Pleasure.
Roberta Newsom and Megan Weatherby are with the Art Deco Society of New York. You can find them online at artdeco.org. Tony W. Robbins is an author, lecturer, and tour leader. He's also an early member of the Art Deco Society. He's online at Anthony W. Robbins, that's Robbins with one B, .com. This is Cityscape on 90.7 FM and WFUV.org. Good morning once again. I'm George Bodarkey. Our next guest is also smitten with Art Deco, so much so she's traveled to the country documenting Art Deco mailboxes. Karen Green is a co-author of the book Art Deco Mailboxes, an Illustrated Design History. Karen, hello.
Good morning. It's very nice to be here.
So first of all, let's just say the mailboxes we're referring to here are not the ones you'll find on the corner of your street, right?
Right. These are mailboxes that are in building lobbies, mostly commercial lobbies, but often in residential lobbies as well, and in hospitals, in railroad stations, anywhere where people gathered.
Not used anymore, though.
Actually, the ones that are there are mostly still in use.
They are.
But they're labeled as convenience to tenants because a lot of the mail chutes are closed.
The mail. So you actually, if you put mail then on the seventh floor down the chute, it's not going down?
Well, the chute is blocked. The chute entrance in a lot of buildings is now blocked. Or they've been, you know, paneled over when the building was renovated. But the mailbox is still in use in the lobby.
The mailbox itself is in use. The chutes are no longer in use.
In many buildings, yeah.
That's also because it's a fire hazard as well. That's what they say?
Yeah. That's why they're not put in new buildings, by and large, because it's an open flue. So if there's a fire with toxic fumes on one floor, the fumes would rise to the other floors.
What inspired you to put this book together?
First of all, I'm fascinated by the Postal Service. You know, whenever I'm at the main post office, I'm always trying to peer behind the window. How does my letter get from here to there? What goes on behind there? But I also, the Cutler Company was from Rochester. And I always had a warm feeling for things from Rochester since I attended the University of Rochester and spent 4 good years of my life up in the snow.
Well, we need to rewind here and explain what the Cutler Company is and who James Gould Cutler was, because he plays a very prominent role in the history of these mailboxes and their chutes.
Well, James Gould Cutler was an architect in Rochester, and he developed and patented the mailbox and mail chute in 1883, and the first mailbox went into an office building in Rochester. And that building no longer exists, but he showed the box, he patented the whole thing, and he showed the box at the exposition where a lot of industrial patents were being shown, and he spread around the country. There were offices of the Cutler Manufacturing Company in New York and all major cities, and he even had patents in Cuba and the United Kingdom and Australia and Canada.
So essentially, he owned the market.
So he owned the market, and he had the monopoly to put mailboxes in government buildings. So around the turn of the century, I think it was about 1905, there were congressional hearings about this monopoly that he had, and and other companies came into the field. So Capital Mail Chute, United States Mail Chute, American Mailing Device. So they all joined the fray. And those are the ones that mostly were on the East Coast. I think Federal Mail Chute was out in California, but I don't know about any other brands. I have to go exploring the rest of the country.
How much did the introduction of the elevator have to do with Cutler's success?
Oh, they were paired, really, because with the second Industrial Revolution, you began to get steel frame buildings, and skyscrapers started to develop. And you couldn't have a skyscraper without an elevator. And then the mail chute made life possible because you didn't have to go down to the lobby to mail a letter or go out to the street to mail a letter. And it's very, it's sort of, I won't say class warfare, but many buildings sold, you know, tenancy and, you know, advertised tenancy in their buildings because of progressive management. It had an elevator and it had a mailbox and mail chute. But when I was talking about class warfare, I meant it was sold to hotels because, you know, with the line that you don't have to tip the bellboy. The bellboy was the lowest paid employee of the hotel. And Cutler's ads suggested that you don't have to tip the bellboy. You can just put your letter in the mail chute.
Where is Cutler's work featured most prominently in New York City today if you wanted to get a look at his mailboxes and chutes?
They're all over. The classic Cutler mailbox before the Art Deco period, Lower Manhattan, the Garment Center, Lower Broadway, they all have the Cutler classic mailbox. The Woolworth Building probably has the most stunning classic mailbox, but the Cutler door with its Gothic eagle and then whatever form fit the environment in the lobby.
So you would know a Cutler mailbox by the eagle,
by
right?
By the Gothic eagle. And it was mail of a period. And that Gothic eagle was the symbol of the Cutler Company. And the factory, which was where Cutler Manufacturing was located from its inception on Anderson Avenue in Rochester, still has that Gothic eagle tile over the door. It's now the Rochester Lead Works, and they make wiring and all sorts of other lead products, but the eagle is still there.
Mercury, the messenger of the gods, is also prominently featured on many of these mailboxes, right? Is that also a Cutler thing or no?
No, not specifically. Mercury began to be used in the 30s. It had a particular meaning to the people who would use the mail. I mean, it was Art Deco and Mercury selling the postal service because he's the god of travelers, safety on the roads, and messages. You know, he was the messenger god, so that going from the earth to the heavens was Mercury's job. He was also a trickster, but that's another part mm-hmm. of his iconography. But people of that period, of the 30s, understood what Mercury meant in terms of messages and transportation and communication. So it became a very, very popular symbol.
Roughly how many mailboxes are featured in this book?
There are little over 100. So a few of them are Cutler. Actually, about a third of them are classic Cutlers of different types, and the rest are Art Deco.
How did you go about identifying where these mailboxes are in New York City and outside of New York as well?
Well, the first thing is that every major city has an Art Deco society, and they usually list the Art Deco buildings. But, you know, they list Art Deco gas stations and theaters, and most buildings needed to be at least six stories before a mailbox went into them. Then you could look at the skyline. There was a particular design of Art Deco buildings with setbacks. So that, you know, the ziggurat style. So the base was broad, and as the building rose, the stories were set back, and the top floors were narrow. So you could look at any skyline and say, that's an Art Deco, that's an Art Deco, that's an Art Deco. And I just walked a lot of streets in the city of New York and in other cities.
And you just walked into these buildings with your camera and snapped a
well,
shot?
Well, no, that's guerrilla photography and very frowned on post 9/11.
Yeah, yeah.
But usually I would ask the guard, the safety officer, the doorman. I'd explain. I'd bring some pictures. And most of them laughed. Are you kidding me? My mailbox.
And these mailboxes are still nicely polished
on
a routine basis.
Oh, they're beautiful. Yeah. They're beautiful. They really, you know, they're part of the lobby furniture and people really take care of them.
What are among your favorite mailboxes in New York City?
Oh, Chrysler Building, the 116 John Street, the Waldorf, has a magnificent eagle. It's the box is closed, but they've kept the box. Oh, 20 Exchange Place.
What does that one look like?
It looks like Mexican hammered silver. I mean, the building was a bank building that mostly handled Southwestern commodities. So there are Native American medallions, all sorts of things around the buildings, and the mailbox has this beaten, it's like beaten silver, although it's not silver, obviously, but a rising sun, the heat waves rising, and geometric designs. So it's just gorgeous.
How many cities outside of New York did you go to explore mailboxes?
Let's see, New York, Philadelphia, Newark, Akron, Ohio, Cincinnati, Chicago. And of course, Chicago, that's the cover of the book. As soon as I walked into the lobby, I said, that's the cover.
And there's
just
the eagle.
Gorgeous. Just gorgeous.
How varied are they from city to city, or are they about the same?
They're very creative. So the Cutler boxes, there was some variability, but I can't say that the variety had to do with the city. I mean, it was about the architect. And one of the most beautiful boxes is in Indianapolis, where it's a three-part mailbox. The top part of the mailbox has Egyptian designs. The middle part has your standard Art Deco deer running through or hounds running through the forest. And then the bottom is an undersea scene of fish and seashells. And the top part of that lower panel is geese flying through the sky. It's just a wonderful, fanciful box.
While many of these boxes have been nicely preserved, you say in the book that many of them have been removed, forgotten, disused, or painted over the years. And occasionally they've been repurposed. But how have they been repurposed? Do you know?
Well, one box I discovered in Lower Manhattan is now, you know, it's still in the lobby, but it stores, the staff store the lobby cleaning supplies in it.
Okay.
Which is one way. And then there are ones that disappear and end up on eBay because there are a lot of postal equipment collectors out there, and they really bid up these mailboxes very, very high. I mean, I think the original price of a mailbox was around $400 to $600 for the regular line boxes. But the on eBay, they're running $1,500, $2,000 for collectors. Mm-hmm. And that's just the box.
Do you have one at home?
No. Well, I have one in my building.
You do? Okay. Yeah,
a Cutler Art Deco model without an eagle. But every once in a while, I'd say, gee, I'd love that in my living room. That would be gorgeous. And then there are boxes that have disappeared. You know, you don't know what happened. When they renovated the building, did the architect take it home, or did the contractor take it home, or the developer take it home? You know, and it's in his man cave with single malt scotch. I don't know, but they're gone.
A funny thing once happened at the McGraw-Hill building on West 42nd Street. What happened there?
Well, it wasn't so funny, actually. About a lot of mail got stuck in the mail chute because people will not just put one letter in at a time. They'll put a stack in. You know, it's a very sleek building. The mailbox was visible, but the mail chute was buried behind the wall, and they had to open the wall to get to the mail. And there were about 21 bags of mail stuck in the mail chute.
Wow.
So it was a significant operation to get the mail out.
Who was your partner in crime for this book, Lynn Lavelle?
Lynn Lavelle's an architectural writer, and she's a very good writer. I tend to be very professorial in my writing, and she has a way of putting things in a perkier way.
What was your main objective with this book? Why was it important for you, for others, to get a view of these mailboxes?
Well, I think I'm an archivist at heart. And although I'm a psychologist, I appreciate architecture. And I am very saddened when I see these glass boxes go up with no particular style, and except that they're tall. So I think I wanted to really preserve this period in American design and post office design, and the partnership between the post office and these private industries.
Well, Karen, thank you so much for coming in.
Oh, and thank you for having me. This has been a pleasure.
That was Karen Green. She's the co-author of the book Art Deco Mailboxes, an Illustrated Design History. It's published by W.W. Norton. And that's it for this week's Cityscape. Past episodes of the show are available in our archives at wfuv.org/cityscape.
You can also subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, like us on Facebook, and follow us on Twitter for show updates and New York City tidbits. I'm George Bodarkey. My thanks to producers Taylor Nulk and Claire Drake. Have a great weekend.
It's WFUV and WFUV HD New York. Listener-supported public media from Fordham, the Jesuit University of New York. Music discovery starts here.